Hello, welcome to Holden Village. Today is Thursday, August 16th, 2001. In the Creekside room this evening is Gail Gamuth McCoy. Today's session number is GAG 2001-4, and it's titled Genesis House Responds to Prostitution. Let's listen in.
Genesis House, there's some extra brochures. If you want to take them back to wherever you live or your congregations, or maybe you're interested in trying to start an organization or be involved with an organization like this, this is just basic information. And if you would want any kind of additional information about our organization, this is where you can contact me or any one of us and get further information on our programming and details and things. This is not my direct line, but it's our fax line and our main phone number, so you can also reach me there. So today, we're going to talk a little bit about Genesis House, and you've probably heard the name around the village because we're here. There's a group of us here. There's nine of us here. Some people are staff, and some are women in recovery. And what we do is help women recover from prostitution, from being victimized by prostitution. So a little about our organization. It was founded in 1983. Originally, one of the first members was a priest. And what had happened to him is he had been working in New York in the 70s, and he was going through the tunnel, I believe, and two women flagged him down, and he assumed they wanted a ride, so, being a good priest. And so when they got into the car, they propositioned him. And his name is Father Paul Jenska, and actually he began to do more than just missionary work. There's sort of a difference between the missionary work and really starting to get involved in the counseling and all that kind of thing. So he was on Phil Donahue twice. He was in Hustler magazine as the priest to the hookers, I think was the article. And then he met up with, he went to CTU, Catholic Theological University in Chicago to get his master's degree. And there he met some lay missionary women who got involved in the cause. And they together began to start Genesis House. At that time, I was a graduate student in the same neighborhood. So I was actually, my assignment was to start a food pantry. And had to research food pantries and how they work and so on. So I remember them in the very, very early stages with collars on, walking up and down the very bad neighborhoods where there was a lot of not only female prostitution, but teenage runaway prostitution, male prostitution, and so on. So we began to form together Genesis House, and at the same time there was another organization called Night Ministry, which was forming. And Night Ministry basically worked with runaway teens and young male prostitutes. And we began to work with female prostitutes and runaway girls. But we still are collaborating together and we work together. And then recently there's an organization called TransGenesis, which originally they were kind of angry at us because we could not take transgenders into our housing. But now we're working together and we're collaborating, and they are for transgendered prostitutes that are out on the streets. And so all of us collaborate and sort of have our little niches, but we take turns going on outreach with one another and doing those kinds of things. So at any rate, the very first thing they did is they began to find and do outreach where the women were walking, where they were on the streets. We would just talk to them. They would go to brothels and sit in brothels and converse and decide what they needed to do. And what they realized immediately was that they needed to find shelter, that they needed to find somewhere that the women could get off the street. So we were able to rent our first building in about 1984, and then began to get money from the church and from other sources to begin to hire administrative staff and counseling staff. And so if you sort of look at the idea of it, there's a spiritual base, and that's the base. And I always think of it a little bit of as a pyramid, but I also think you have to build on that to really help the women recover. You have to build with counseling, clinical services, job training, health care, parent training, and child care, and all these other things. So just the ministry enough needed to be built upon. So actually, believe it or not, we were one of the first people in the world to have that idea, to go beyond ministry and taking people in and begin to rehabilitate women in prostitution. And if you think about that idea, we've rehabilitated, you know, mass murderers who want to give counseling to, all kinds of, you know, sociopaths. But the total idea of working with courts and going in and trying to rehabilitate women in prostitution was a completely new idea at that time. So there were a couple in the country that sprang up together around the same time. There was San Francisco, I think, had an organization, Minnesota, and we all pretty much, LA, sort of started at the same time doing similar things. The first big influx of money for Genesis House came, unfortunately, with the HIV/AIDS epidemic, because women in prostitution were identified as being at high risk and having a lot of multiple health problems. So we received funding for the Center for Disease Control fairly early on, and that boosted our outreach. So now we had a lot more outreach workers, and we made the decision at that time to hire women in recovery from prostitution and substance abuse. So nearly, I believe, 100% of our outreach workers are in recovery. You have to be in recovery for a minimum of 2 years and have a sponsor. And also in our work, we do random drug testing, not only with our residents, but also if we need to with our workers, so that we really have to exercise that. And one reason is, of course, if somebody's in relapse, their coworkers are the first one to know and the first one to confront them. So it really doesn't have to go very often to the administrative level. So as we grew, basically, this is what started to happen with programming. We had one house. It had 4 beds. And then we began to get money from the CDC. So we opened another site on the west side of Chicago, which is a very dangerous and still gang-infiltrated neighborhood. It was a neighborhood during the riots in the 60s that was burned down. There was a lot of rioting there, and there's nothing much has been rebuilt there. You see a lot of empty lots and so forth. A lot of prostitution, a lot of substance abuse, a lot of gangs, a lot of gang shootings. So that's where our second place was. From time to time, we had people living there, but because of the break-ins and a lot of crack houses around it, we never made that facility a 24-hour facility. Our Northside facility is a block and a half from Wrigley Field, which is, we have no parking lot, so let us say that I've had the boot there and my car towed away. Because, you know, you look out and you see the police, you're like, no, because you have to move them at 4 and 5 and 6 and 7. So we have to schedule all our business meetings around Cubs games and what time we're going to be here. Or there actually is an L stop, you know, right across the street. So if I take the L, because if I tell someone to come and I forget there's a Cubs game, by the time you open the door, they're like, I'm sorry, don't you take the L. So our Northside site is our original site, and that's a 24-hour crisis center. So what we do there is 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, 365 days a year, we welcome any woman in prostitution, no matter where she's at in her disease and her illness. So if she's still using, she's still prostituting, she's still on drugs, she's drunk, it doesn't matter, she's welcome there. Unless, of course, she's violent or abusive, then we would ask her to leave, or she's leaving crack pipes in the bathroom, which has happened. So we would ask you to leave if you're doing that. Otherwise, we're very open, and the women themselves who are living in the house, the residents, are to give hospitality. They're to pay back. Everyone's offered a meal. We are a food pantry there, and we are a food pantry on the west side, and we are a clothing pantry. Our hope is, in a non-judgmental way, that if they do ever feel that they're ready for recovery, that they'll remember us and they'll come to us because of the way we treated them with respect and dignity. Now, in some cases, we have women that are dying of AIDS, and we know that they're never going to recover. And so our idea is just to make their life or the end of their life a little bit better and surround them with some love and some caring. And there's one of my favorite women who's actually dying of AIDS. Ingrid spoke about an employee who's dying, I think, for all of you that were Vespers. But this woman, I was walking down the stairs, and she looked at me, and she said, Gail, you know, when I die, will you bury me in the backyard? Yeah. And it was touching, because that's where she really feels she wants to be. And, you know, of course, I explained, I think there's a city ordinance against that, actually. So I don't think we can do that. But what we do at Genesis House is if someone dies and we know them, believe it or not, there are recycled cemetery stones, which I didn't know. I found out recently. So people may not like the hummingbird in the corner, or it's not quite the right shade of pink granite, and they actually refuse these stones. The stones are then ground down, and you can buy them for a fraction of what they were originally. So I buy those stones when I know that, you know, we can help someone be buried and they don't have to go to Potter's Field or whatever you want to call it, and we'll make sure they get a stone on their grave and that they get a proper ceremony. I'm telling you these little bit of stories because we're not a traditional institution. We're a little bit different because we maintain our spirituality base and where we came from. And so we extend ourselves, I think, a lot more beyond any drug treatment program or anything like that. So what happened after we got our west side is we continued to have an influx of money, and then it was mismanaged. And then Genesis House nearly went broke and almost closed all of its doors. And at that point, I was hired, which was about 5.5, 6 years ago, to try and rebuild the organization. So what happened is everybody who stayed on as staff took big pay cuts. I took about 25% pay cut at that time and borrowed money from my dear auntie, who's now departed, and other people borrowed money so that we could keep the organization going and keep it alive. And luckily, I think it was interesting because the employees who didn't believe in the mission left. And basically, sort of who you had there was the cream of the crop in a way in terms of employees. There were people that really believed in the program and believed so much that they would take a pay cut to stay there. During that time period, we were able to keep our residential program going and all our outreach programs going, and everybody just worked twice as hard. And then I basically went on the road and spoke and spoke and spoke and spoke, and we got our funding back. And then through there, we've reached a phenomenal growth period. So what happened when we got all our funding back and then increased our funding, and I think we went from zero to something like, it'll be over $2 million budget this year in about a 3 or 4 year period. And that was because of the hard work of everyone and staff and board members and everybody who really got behind it. And a lot of people in the media and the public got behind us. For example, a big media company took us on as a pro bono client.
Wow.
And yeah, and so put us on all the websites and wrote all the newspapers. So anytime there was a newspaper story or a news story, they came to Genesis House because of this pro bono marketing firm that helped us. So a lot of people helped us. A lot of volunteers came and sat at the desk, kept the doors open. And as a result of that, we were then able to increase our outreach and open this year a Southside office. And so now we cover the entire city because, of course, east is the lake. So we don't have office out in the lake yet in Lake Michigan. So we opened our Southside office, and that now has 20-some beds. It's very, very big office. And we were also able to buy a vehicle, a big RV, which I'd never been RV shopping in my life, so this was a real experience, you know. I mean, some of them have movie screens that come down, and they have, ours has a slide, and it slides out, and it becomes very large, and it has an awning. And we had the king-size bed pulled out, and in that back area, we put two offices. And so in the back, we have a nurse, and we have a case manager, we have a full-time driver, and we have outreach workers who are on that vehicle. So all over the city of Chicago, our vehicle, which has Genesis House on it, goes at night when the women are working, overnight, and the outreach workers get off of that bus and they go out and they find the women and they talk about Genesis House and they talk about family planning and they talk about safe sex. And if the woman looks sick, then they bring her onto the bus and the nurse begins some diagnostic kind of work. We have free nursing at two of our sites and tells her which office she can go back to. We do OraSure, the oral HIV testing, hepatitis, and sexually transmitted disease. For that reason, we've partnered with the Chicago Department of Health and have begun to see a lot of funding coming in from the Chicago Department of Health because Chicago is very high for STDs in the country. It's one of the higher cities for sexually transmitted diseases. So that allowed us to really stretch our reach all over and for people to get really familiar with us. what we had to do with that vehicle, it's one of those things where you say, be careful what you wish for, you might get it. I'll write these, we'll design these brands, and they're sort of fantasies.
Oh, I want a Southside office, I want a big truck, and it's going to go all over the city of Chicago.
And then you get the money. It's like, who wants to be a millionaire, And I've got to do this great thing. You actually have to do what you said you're going to do, because there's heavy reporting, statistical record keeping, and all that kind of thing. So actually getting this program off the ground was very difficult. And I think we had it for, 8 weeks, Wanda? And then we're about seven smash wrecks.
Yeah.
And then somebody took it home to their mom's house and just backed it into the garage and smashed the ladder on the back. Why did I do this? Now I have to be worried. There's actually a sheet that the driver has to fill out, but of course, obviously, they're not going to fill it out when they just smashed it against something in an alley. So we have to have it inspected all the time now by an outside employee who's our development person, actually, one of them. And he goes and inspects and takes pictures and brings it, and then he puts them through my computer, and I'm like, I want to see what David's report is. Yeah. I will say they're all minor things, and I think it's because it's such a huge vehicle, and they're going into We have a professional driver. We have a new driver now.
Oh, yeah.
We just hired a new driver, and the incidents have gone down. And it's minor damage. But it just gives you an idea of you have these idealistic, this is going to be the greatest thing. And then there's these little everyday sort of, and I tend to be an idealist, so when I have to deal with seven smashes and our slide isn't working, I have to come down to kind of reality level and then get involved with the insurance company with our business manager and do that kind of thing. So I'm going to tell you a little bit also about another outreach program we have, and that's our court and jail program. At this juncture, I would say it seems that we're now the largest organization in the United States for this type of programming. Not in the world, I think there's a larger one in Europe than us. And I visited most of them in the United States, and we saw 13,000 women and girls last year. This year we've doubled our capacity with the South Side and the vehicles, so we feel it will probably be over 20,000, and it may even double. It might be as high as 26,000 this year. That would include everyone we give meals to, everyone we give a shot to, or a sure to, clothing to, counseling to, case management, a bed overnight before they get into a treatment center, and our residents. It would include every contact throughout the organization was about 13,000 last year. Our core program is called Unhooked. That program started years ago with a judge, and this woman was sort of an evangelist. Her name is Corinne Edwards, and she's on television now internationally, but at that time she had changed careers and she wanted to help Genesis House. And that's a condition of bond program. So our women, our outreach workers, go into the jails and they go into lockup and they talk to the public defenders and they talk to the judges and they advocate for the women. And they try and tell the woman to come to Genesis House and give her ideas about coming to us. If she then opts for our program, which is called Unhooked, she comes to Genesis House for an intensive day program. For example, how you learn, initially it was a 3-day program where they had to be there every day at a certain time and leave at a certain time. And we quickly learned that when people are still using drugs and prostituting, it's kind of unrealistic to stay here 3 days in a row at 10 o'clock. Life doesn't work that way. So we decide to keep the same hours and make it intensive in one day so you get the same counseling. But additionally, you get lunch and you get to meet the case manager. And different people in our employ take different things like substance abuse, self-esteem, Genesis House, keeping safe, different things all through the day. You meet the case manager and you get lunch. Well, and then if they attend, we give that information back and they're not arrested. They're free. And what we found is that a woman who comes who had no intention probably at the time she was picked up, who comes there, about 50% of the women came back for some type of service, which is fantastic. And mostly for drug treatment, mostly for case management. So it shows you that maybe someone who had no intention, now that they can see a face and people were kind there and gave them a sandwich and gave them support and they know the address where to come back now, that little spark, at least 50%, come back for help. Currently, we have studied a program in Hawaii that is actually about an 8-week program that is also a mandated court program. We have put in for funding for that, actually from CSAT SAMHSA, which is substance abuse, blah, 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 mental health, blah, blah, in Washington, and CSAT, Center for Substance Abuse Treatment. And they called right when I left for further questions. So that would be a huge court program. It would be 8 weeks, very intensive, and it would probably have a much higher success rate, obviously, than the one-day program that we have. So we're very hopeful, because that entails a whole new staff and a whole new branch of our programming. So I'll go back to a little bit. We have about 30-some beds now. We're in the process of opening our Southside beds. That's a day office right now, and a crisis office, and a drop-in center, and so on. And we're just getting the funding now for the 20-some beds, which will give us 30-some beds, however many we can fit. Because we always end up fitting more beds somewhere. But I'll talk about the Northside programming and how the residential program works, which I think interests a lot of people. Women who come in, we have a long, 75-person normally waiting list to get into our program. We get calls every single day from everywhere, from Iowa prisons. In fact, Iowa was a little odd the first time I got a call, and they told me it's because of the gambling boats. So wherever you see gambling, you see prostitution. And wherever you see a gambling boat or an off-track betting center, or any kind of gambling, there's prostitution going on there. And I actually was out with a friend, and I couldn't figure out, we're in a relatively nice neighborhood in Chicago, and he had gotten out of the car to look at something, and he was approached by a woman in prostitution, and you know, I was thinking, well, that's kind of weird, there's only restaurants around here. But then I looked at around the corner, there was an off-track betting parlor. And you know, I was kind of like, where's my brochure? You know, do something about this. But then I figured it out, you know. So there are connections you don't ordinarily make, but you sort of start to make them when you're working in our field. In Chicago, for example, because of the conventions, the hotels, the convention center, so often a woman will just, you know, when they're having their big cocktail parties or whatever they're having after the lecture, a woman will just slip into that room and she'll work the room there at conferences. In the city of Chicago, there's estimated 45,000 to 50,000 men, women, and children in prostitution, involved in prostitution. Just gives you, and that also entails the surrounding collar counties, that's Cook County and all those areas. And it's very high also in the state. And as I might have mentioned yesterday, places like Rockford and Aurora, when we talk about trafficking, who've seen a lot of migration, a lot of migrant workers and people of that nature, the prostitution's booming in all these different small towns, and they're asking us to set up programming. But anyway, to get into our program, which depending on the year, I think our average is probably 70% success rate of completely rehabilitating the women, and that means staying off drugs and staying out of prostitution for as long as we can track you. And we've tracked most of our women for up to a decade now, so it's not just a year of tracking, it's a decade. One of those reasons is, again, going back to spirituality, is the program is based on home-like family atmosphere. And so they are welcome back at any time. They're welcome back to come and get clothing, food, counseling, case management at any time in their lives, and it's completely free. There's no charge for any of our services. And we used to have kind of a joke, you know, if we demand money, where are they going to get it? You know? It's counterproductive. Yeah. We want $10 right now. Not a real smart idea, so right there. we try and base our programming on logic 101, sort of. So we have this waiting list, and we get calls from everywhere. Prisons, jails, lawyers, drug treatment centers, domestic violence centers, from everywhere. And it's very difficult for us, and it's very sad for us when we don't have beds. And that is almost always the truth, that we don't have beds. And by the time we get a bed, normally that person has moved on because they're maybe getting out of drug treatment, and they need a bed now. They don't need a bed in a month or 6 weeks or 8 weeks. They need it now. So my personal goal is to find more and more beds. I mean, that's really what I'm committed to, and finding more and more places where the women can go and stay and live, because that is the key to rehabilitation. They come, they have to go, if they're using drugs there or alcohol, which is 99% of the time this is true, they must go to drug treatment first before they enter our facility. That's because on the continuum, some women may be ready for graduation, others may be there a month, but someone right off the street who hasn't had any drug treatment or counseling would disrupt the community by coming in. So we want them to go through drug treatment, and we then call back and forth to their counselors there at drug treatment and find out, how are they doing? Are they going through the program well? And did they succeed, and did they get out of the program all right? If they do, then we allow them to come into our program. It's about a 10 to 14 month program, depending on the woman's progress. It's not, you came in at this day and you have to leave this day. It's very individualized case management for each person. The first 30 days are orientation period. You do not get your own bed or your own bedroom at that time. You literally sleep on the couch in the living room, and you see and decide if you can be part of our community and if you can work in the community. It's a very strict kind of environment. You have to get up in the morning at 7 o'clock, and there's meditation. There are mandatory groups. You may have a contract when you come in. For example, if we know that you're bipolar, or we know that you have to take medication, that will be part, that you will sign a release of confidentiality, and we'll be able to talk to your therapist, and we'll make sure you're taking that medication. If you stop doing that, we can ask you to leave Jonas's house. So just to get in, you know, we both, and they have to decide that they, you know, they might prefer a halfway house where it's not really a program, where you can do kind of what you want to do whenever you want to do, although in halfway houses we know there's a lot of people still using drugs and alcohol. So we make that really clear up front. This is what we expect of you. We go over the rules. Each woman is assigned weekly duties, cleaning, cooking, taking care of the yard, you know, whatever it is that they have to do, and they change. And each woman has to cook a meal for the community, and there's a community mandatory dinner where you sit down every night and you eat as a community. So it still retains those strong sort of community feelings. And the only time that a woman gets out of that dinner is when she finally has a job and she can't get home in time, or she's working, and then we'll allow you to do that. The programming's pretty intensive. We have, we're working on post-traumatic stress syndrome and trauma survivor counseling. Maria in the back is our excellent clinician, and she's our clinical coordinator there. Wanda is our house manager. Every single thing going in that house. I don't know what I would do without Wanda there. She, since we're a food pantry, we actually have to go to the food depository and pick up food and get the food in. We're at a program with the Jewel food stores whereby when they get rid of their sandwiches and salads and all of that because they're day over, they bring those all there and we feed those to crisis clients. Wanda keeps all of that going, pickups, donations, mountains of clothing, twin beds, refrigerators, washers and dryers. She has to sort through all that and keep it going, and also make sure the paperwork and the logging is going. When the women come in, it's somewhat like, if you think of a medical setting, we have 7 to 3 shift, 3 to 11, and 7 to 3 or whatever.
Seven.
They log. Each person logs, like in a hospital setting, so that the next person coming on knows what happened and what transpired. Also because women might behave differently at night. You know, someone might be great during the day, and you would never know that night a fight broke out between two people. And until, unless you have that log, and that's a lot of our communication there. We also have team meetings of the residential staff, where they discuss each and every client there from everyone's perspective, the night person's perspective, the day person's perspective, what's going on at dinner. And it's not negative either. Maybe someone found out that their mother went into the hospital and they're very upset, and that call came at 9 o'clock, 10 o'clock at night. So the morning staff needs to know that maybe that person's not going to be herself. She might have to go to the hospital that day to see her mother, so to have special privileges, maybe someone escort her. So we really try and keep up with how are the women feeling, how are they doing. Now, many times I've been asked, is there any violence there? Does anything bad ever happen? And I always laugh and I say, if anybody tried to hurt me, I have 8 women that wouldn't let them near me. I thought, oh, I mean, I was meeting your residents ever. And I said, no, we don't have that problem there. I think it's because psychologically it is their home. And you will find that if someone comes in and they're disruptive, before we have to call staff, a resident will take care of it. A resident would tell that person to behave or whatever, you know, stop. I know about 2 years ago when Rosa, who some of you don't know, she was a great residential director, I heard a scuffle downstairs, so I ran down from my office just in time to see someone pulling somebody out of the closet by their feet, who seemed to have her hands on some shoes, and about that one with this huge man was in the doorway, who apparently was with the crisis client. And here's Rosa, this little girl, of course from New York. And she runs up to this big guy, and I'm like, ah! You know, I'm calling 911 while Rosa's having it out with this 6'2", 3 guy in the hallway, and I'm like, it's called 911, you know? She's telling him off, and then we ran outside and we got his license plate number, because he told us he was a policeman and he was going to come back and get us and all that kind of thing. So we got his license plate number. But if I'm pointing out, because if there's ever an incident, it's from the outside. It's something that's happened from the outside. It's not within us. We usually solve our problems as a community. They have community meetings where they discuss, how are they getting along? How are we getting along with one another? Are there issues in the house? Does something seem fair? Does something seem unfair? Now, if something happens where we feel as a staff that the women are getting maybe too many directions, maybe not focused on the recovery, maybe we see relapse behavior in someone, at times the house will be closed down for a weekend, and there won't be any passes given. And the purpose of that is to refocus on your recovery and your spirituality and the community, and to be brought back into the community. We try and make that a non-punitive thing. We try and make it getting good films, popping popcorn, having counseling people come in and lead groups. But if we really feel like something's going to be disrupted and break down, we will shut down the house and we'll bring everybody back to their center and where they need to be. And that doesn't happen that often. I mean, that's infrequent. But it's normally to try and keep someone from leaving or relapsing when we do something like that. It's because everybody's been watching the house closely and they'll say, okay, you know, we need to shut down the house. So after the month, it's really a happy day. It's funny, something as small as a bad Katrina's smiling, but it's like, I made it, you know, I've got my bed and I've got my own dresser and I've got my room and so on. We have 8 beds there and 2 crisis beds, which are actually the couch, sleeper sofas. And if we get more crisis clients, they just sleep there wherever we can find for them to sleep. Again, we go back to our ministry roots and we do not turn people away. It's very important. I will only let my staff not open the door, and I have to constantly kind of drum this in, if it looks really frightening. I mean, if somebody's standing out there with 2 men or something like that, and that looks scary to the staff member, then she would not have to open the door at 3 o'clock in the morning. But if it's a woman standing alone, you have to open that door. You have to let her in. And the way the people come is, of course, our outreach units are out there. Mm-hmm. So our outreach units are on the streets, and they're telling them if the woman's hurt or sick or something, they say, go there. And then in the morning, you can move on. And normally, we send those women to drug treatment. If they refuse to go to drug treatment, they stay only one night on the crisis bed. Then the next night, we will send them to a crisis shelter. But if they want to be case managed and they want to go into drug treatment, we'll keep them as many nights as we have to until they get into that drug treatment facility. So there's a little difference between those who will not, who, you know, don't want any case management or counseling, and then we move them on. And we have relationships with shelters. In fact, our former executive director runs Rest Shelter. So luckily for us, we have an in with Rest Shelter. So the women, after this 30 days, are really involved in what their programming is. Right away, we apply for housing. That's one of the first things we do because we know housing takes a long, long time to come through. So immediately, sometimes even in the first week, we've applied for housing if we know they'll have no housing to go to. Then we do an individual evaluation. What do you need counseling for? You know, could it be incest? Could it be sexual assault issues? Could it be depression? And we work with outside organizations, not just within ourselves, with mental health centers and so on, to collaborate for specializations in therapy and with psychiatrists and so on. Then we look at your job. What do you want for a job? What are we looking at? Do you want computer training? Would you rather go into trades? For example, in Chicago, there's something called Women in Trades. So if you would like to do that and eventually, you know, be union and make a pretty good salary. One of our women now is a chef, and she had gone through that program while she was with us, and she was always a great cook. So we just look at what's your aptitude. We also provide within our organization GED. So if the women don't have their GED, we have actually a sister from Taiwan, and she is an amazing person. And she teaches all of our GEDs and does counseling and is wonderful. She's actually based at our West Side office, but she goes from office to office and teaches and offers GED and encourages the woman. And she's just great. And when I talk a little bit about her trafficking, when we took down all the languages that our staff spoke, I mean, I think she has something like 5 or 6 languages. She's a great asset to us. So we began that. However, the women cannot work for 6 months. Now, whenever I say that, you can imagine people are horrified. Oh, why don't you let them work for 6 months, you know? Because I think there's this mentality that everybody should be out, should be working right away. Get out there, you know, start earning money. The reality is, and I have argued this so many times, these women have all held jobs. Nobody is lazy. Nobody does not want to work. The fact is they've lost or quit every job they had and relapsed with drugs, alcohol, and prostitution. So the real issue is not, can you go out tomorrow and work at Burger King? Of course you can. There's a second issue under that. We want their jobs, if we can help and guide it, to be something that contributes to their self-esteem and is a better chosen job than just working at the drugstore overnight. So we discourage and have actually pulled people out of jobs. I mean, we have to discourage them. Come on, I got a job. No! And it's real weird for them, you know. You tell us, you know, what do you mean I have to quit my job? I went out and got it, you know. Because we determine when we think they're ready. We determine when we think they're ready to handle that paycheck. And the paycheck's not going to be a trigger. Because what you see is sometimes when they have that paycheck, they come back the first time, and they come back maybe the second paycheck, third, fourth paycheck, if they're not ready, they're gone. They don't come back to the house. So we've learned that by experience. Wait. Wait until they're ready, and they feel strong enough to be getting a paycheck every week, and they can handle that paycheck, and they like the job. And it's a job they're not going to quit, or it's not negative, or it's not a sexist environment. But we really try. Every once in a while something slips through and it's not the right job for them. But we try to really guide that process so it is a job they'll stick with and they'll feel happy in. So after around 6 months, and we've really done a lot of therapy, we've done all of that work, we've got the job, training maybe going, we have done a lot of therapy. We maybe reunite with your children. About 80% of women in prostitution have children under the age of 18. So in many cases, what's going on too, simultaneously, is family reunification. And that's one of our biggest goals. And we will have the children there. We'll observe the woman relating with her children. On the south side, what we want to have is overnight rooms for the kids, so the kids can spend the night. We'll work with, in Chicago, it's the Department of Children and Family Services, DCFS. So we work with DCFS. We go and testify about the woman. Because we do random drops, we'll say, you know, that she's clean, she's not using drugs or alcohol, she's completing the program. And oftentimes, the culmination at the end is the woman getting her children back for our graduates. So along the way, we're working on parenting and working on what are your own issues as kids. You know, what happened to you as a child? So we can make sure not to repeat any patterns with the kids that are coming up with them. Our house is open for them to come back all the time. Beyond that, our biggest holiday party, a Christmas party, we do have at Christmas, and every single person that's ever graduated, who's with us, all their kids, all their relatives, everybody's invited. And we tell all of our donors, we try and really see what the kids want, instead of, you know, junk that nobody wants, no cool kid wants, you know. It's like they want walkmans, I mean, they don't want something nobody else wants. So we really try and interview the kids so they don't get hand-me-downs and they really get what they want for Christmas. And we'll find out their age and what sex and his name and all that. And then we have, this year we had so many presents, we really had a free-for-all, so we've got to like kind of redo. And then we had books that we just spread all over a table, and all the kids could come and take any book they wanted, and all the books were gone. And we must have about 100 books there this year. And that's a big party where everybody comes back to our family. Now we have to have it in the ballroom. We had a, like, what do we have?
A DJ.
We had a variety of music. And we had all kinds
house
of
music.
House music. So that's a great time, and we try and get the word out to all of our graduates and their children to come back. There's a lot of ways we try and keep everyone in the fold. And what happens is, they become family. So if someone's having a problem in the family, they will call us. Mm-hmm. And they will say, you know, I'm really worried about so-and-so. Her son's not coming to school. And word out that she's back on the street or something like that. So they extend our eyes and our ears so we can help someone. We've done actual interventions of going into a person's home, getting the baby, getting the little boy, and standing there in the house and saying, you have to go back into drug treatment. Mm-hmm. And actually, the people who came over there initially were graduates. I remember that story. Yeah. And one of the graduates was like, I wanted to slap her. You know, she was so angry. You know, and we're grabbing babies and kids. Yeah. That little boy is so cute. And said, you know, you have to go back in or we're going to call DCFS. You know, we're going to tell them what's going on in this house. So we do keep up with our residents. So at the end of all this intensive stuff, and we've worked all this out, and everybody's had their scuffles throughout the program, and got mad about having their passes pulled, and all the good things, we have what we call graduation.
Yay!
Yay! And we have two people ready for graduation, Terry and Katrina. If you don't, you don't have to. If you feel like it, feel free. And that's when we decide and you decide together that all the criteria have been met. That everything we wanted you to do and everything that you wanted to accomplish in that time has been met. And we agree on that. We agree together. Most at that point, they have a job. When they do get a job, we do it just seemed the simplest thing. It's a third, a third, a third. A third goes into rent to contribute to the organization. A third goes into mandatory savings, which we manage for them. And a third is their spending money. So when they are ready to graduate and they need to put money down on an apartment and they need a new telephone and they need a stereo and all that, we hand over that check to them. And we keep track of it. So it might be couple thousand dollars. It could be a lot of money, and they need that for the deposit on the apartment, whatever they might need. But we do manage the money for them normally. Unless, sometimes we do allow them to have passbooks as long as they're showing us the passbook on a weekly basis and that the savings in there. And we do try to individualize that. But sometimes we found if we don't manage it, then graduation comes and they don't have any money in their savings account. They don't have any deposit. They don't have money for a new alarm clock or whatever. Just right before graduation, I'd like to say also we celebrate birthdays. And we have a $40 or so limit. Is it your birthday?
Tuesday.
Oh. So we don't have much more than that. We have about a $40 limit. Where they can pick out what they want. Again, it's not something that's donated. It's what do you want? And it's sometimes been something like a pair of shoes for church. I mean, they're always pretty practical things that they want, but they want to be new. And we feel that's very important. You know, not everything comes through donations, but it's what you want, what you pick out. So at graduation, it's kind of similar to, sometimes it's a graduation, but it's also like sending someone off to college or in their first home. We try and save in storage donations which they'll need. So if it's a stereo, television, telephone that gets whisked away, people wonder where it goes, and we keep it for graduates. And it's frustrating because we can't keep a lot of good furniture that's donated when the time comes. And we might even, we're considering renting a storage space because you really can't mandate when's the double bed going to come or the dresser. And it's hard, and they, you know, people donate it. Let's see, can we stick it on the ceiling? I mean, we really don't want to depend on the room. We have no room in any of our houses now. And the south side's getting filled up already. But, and the west side's filled. You know, there's no place for that. So we have a ceremony where the women can invite anybody that they want to that's significant in their lives. Any significant others, family, friends. If they have a significant other, relationship, their sponsors, whoever it is, and they're all welcome. And we have a huge banquet where the women cook, and they cook for days normally for this. It's just unbelievable food. And we buy presents. Not only do we encourage our board members and everybody to give presents. Normally we encourage gift certificates to, like, I don't know if you have Carson's in your town, but it would be similar to, and Target, and different department stores, so the women can go out and pick out the color towels they want or whatever they might want and give them gift certificates to the stores. But we also wrap a lot of gifts and have big piles of gifts and cakes. And we do a ceremony, and part of it's spiritual with a prayer. Sometimes they're singing, and sometimes the women themselves have put on a show singing. What was that song that I was used to sing? You know, which one is that one? You know, we don't hold blame. But there was a traditional song that we'll have to find and pass on. And then we take a vase, and the vase is a white woman and a black woman who are fused to create a vase. And inside we have lots of flowers, and each person wants to say something about her, takes a flower, and normally says why that flower reminds them, if it's pink or whatever, and this reminds me of you, and they put it in the vase and say something about her. And at the end, it's this huge bouquet. And we also do a candle lighting ceremony. Yes. Oh, I thought you had some. So, we also do a candle lighting ceremony, and then at the end, they actually get a diploma, which is signed by the organization. And we then move them in physically with our vehicles into their house. So that would sort of be the culmination of the whole programming. And I see that it's getting very late. But do you have any questions? Or would anybody like to say anything who's in the program right now?
I've been at Genesis House on August 25th, will be 18 months. And I just want to take this opportunity to thank the board members, the ones that are here presently and in spirit, Gail McCoy, all the staff, the outreach workers, the residential staff. just to thank them for carrying the message that women can and do recover from drug addiction and prostitution. I'm grateful for Genesis House because it's of Genesis House who I am today. Genesis House has helped build character in me. Because of Genesis House, I'm an A student at one of the city colleges. And when I return August 20th, I'll start a new position as an office assistant for a highly enterprising architect firm.
When we get back, she'll be moving to her new apartment. Yeah.
Not because of Genesis House, she's an A student.
Yeah. Well, all the homework and the paperwork we have to write with our writers. Okay. That definitely contributed to my study.
It's a very structured program. It's very structured and a lot of assignments about finding out about yourself, sometimes even poetry, art therapy. We have students that we're very grateful for who come in and work with the women, take them out. I think last week the student took them to Navy Pier for just a really fun day out on the Ferris wheel. But we have a lot of volunteers that might come in and do something very specialized for us, like art therapy, who totally volunteer their time. Former board member who's written a very nice book on spirituality comes in and works with her book and does things with the women. Ingrid helps us get to Holden Village every year. We couldn't do it without our students and our volunteers and our board members. Our board members take the women out once a month on an outing. And last time, I don't know if you've ever heard of Charlie Trotter's. It's one of the most famous four-star restaurants in the country. That's where we went. We're all at Charlie Trotter's eating, you know, and what was it, 9 courses, 8 courses? It's fabulous. We found out that Charlie Trotter donates to 100 charities, 100 annually, and we were just one of the people that he donated this entire meal to, as in a private room, and we want to offer. And there's a funny picture of Kurt in the wine cellar, going like, too much wine. Couple sessions, how do I keep it up? And I think this is the session that really lets you know how we all keep it up. There's a lot of joy and a lot of camaraderie, and I think we really do try and come from a non-punitive way. If there's something that has to be done, we try and do it in a positive, growth-oriented, but we still have to set limits and boundaries and do those things.
Should we point out that a number of the women who are visiting Holden this week had to make up their, several of them are working, and they had to make up their hours ahead of time. To their workplaces and just work their butts off to save up enough hours so they could come on this trip. So they really
And Debbie is making book covers and book markets, and she suggested that we start a cottage industry to save money to contribute towards the trips.
Cool.
And that's, we want to thank Holden too, because there's no who doesn't mention what part Holden had in that, in her some type of spiritual awakening, something she found out about herself. They always, when they stand up and give their speech, as they do at graduation, they mention the Holden experience. It's very rare that someone would mention that. So thank you.
Yes.
Thank you very much.
That's wonderful.
I just wanted to say, I was one of the people that had to make the decision coming to Holden and going to work. And Genesis House has really, that was one of my first problems is decision making. You know, you take me to the restaurant, I'm gonna get what you get. Because I don't wanna decide. And so I had to decide whether to come to Holden, something I needed to do or work. And I had this big turmoil within myself, but it was already worked out for me. I mean, my job gave me vacation days, and I just started the job 3 months ago. And I needed to come here. Not that I wanted to, I needed to come here. It's a healing. I've been in Dennis's house 14 months today. You know, I put up resistance because it's a place where I can, if I want to voice my feelings, where my feelings were locked away because I didn't have a chance to tell somebody what I wanted, what I didn't want. I had to go along just to get along and to be someplace where it's much structure, but it's just that much love. That's what I need, you know. And I'm going to always be a part of Genesis House. It's more than just a graduation, it's a family. Mm-hmm. It really is.
Thank you,
Terry.
Thank you, too.
We do hire our graduates, and we just testified in front of one of the state reps about some funding. And it was very interesting because he did ask me how I keep track of my graduates, and three of them had actually testified that day. And I didn't want to divulge that because there's a confidentiality issue, but I sort of smiled and I said, we keep track. We also hire them. I think our oldest, how long has she worked for us now?
10. It's going to be
10 years. As the longest a graduate who's still in our employ now today. And is a terrific outreach worker. And I mean, this woman, they've stuck, you know, guns, gangs, in alleys. And she said she threw up her condoms and went, oh, my health care, oh. And they told her, you get out of here. If we see you back here, we're going to kill you. And she said she stood in a doorway and a new outreach worker ran away from her, ran home, didn't call 911, just ran to the house, closed the door. And she somehow got out of there and waited. And the gang kept coming around. She got up. That woman still is an outreach worker.
Yeah. Wow.
I mean, that just tells you the belief, you know, how she believes in it because she graduated from the program. And she'd do anything. I mean, she does anything. She's an eloquent speaker. But she was here. But she testified. And so we hire as many graduates. But oftentimes, they go on to, you know, much different worlds. But if they come to us and they want to be hired, normally they are hired.
Mm-hmm. Speaking as the board president, I would just like to say that we would be happy to partner with any of your congregations, and you could give donations to us, and we could invite you to come and visit us, and we could have some kind of partnership relationship.
My name is Yvonne, and I've been in Justice House since June 8th of this year, and I can just say that Justice House has changed my life dramatically. With the structure and the new life skills that I'm learning there. And I'm just very grateful for Wanda, Maria, and Gail. They entered my life and changed it a lot.
Hello, my name is Bonita. I've been with Genesis House about 11 months. And Genesis House has really worked in my life because when I came there, I was very stubborn. I want to do what Benita wanted to do, you know, but even though times I got consequences, they still showed me a lot of love and let me know that I still could voice my opinion, but it was just certain things that I wasn't going to be able to do. taught me how to wake up in the morning because I was used to sleeping all day. You know, I was lazy, and they taught me how to get up, be at meditation. They also taught me, now I get up every morning, go to work. I wanted those ones to make a decision to either come. Because when they first said about Genesis House, I had just started my job, and I was like, I'm not going to no hold and quit my job. Yeah. You know, but when they talked to me, they was like, you can always get another job and everything. You know, your boss will be able to understand. You know, it's something that you need to experience and things like that, you know. But I was hiding. I was like, I ain't quit my job. I don't care what they say. But I went to my boss, and I asked him, my boss let me come. So I'm truly grateful that I came. And I will always be a part of Genesis House.
That's right.
How do you want to get work for?
Wow, that was beautiful.
Yeah. Hi, I'm Debbie.
Hi.
I'm also a resident in Genesis House. I can truthfully say that with God in my life at Genesis House and all the loving staff there, that I am alive today. Mm-hmm. And on the first, I'll have 9 months clean. And I'm working real hard at in a lot of areas, but I think mostly what keeps me focused is on my second anniversary, I want to be hired on the outreach truck. Really one of my goals that I've set, and even if I'm not hired, I will volunteer only because I need to give back what was so freely given to me. I love Gail for what she does. We call her the real McCoy. She doesn't let us get away with anything.
It's not Lutheran in me.
She's never really down there, but she seems to always know what we're doing. And that look, we all know that look. I have Wanda in my life. I'm real close to her in a lot of ways. She gives me inspiration every day. Maria's helping me get honest with myself. And that's something real hard for me to do. Okay. I'm just real grateful to Genesis House because without God, like I said, in Genesis House, I would have died if I hadn't been rescued and mandated there by the Chicago Police Department. From day one, I was welcomed with open arms. Anybody that is blessed to walk through the doors, we open our arms and our hearts to them, and it's given without. I mean, sometimes we're like, oh God,
this one's really bad.
For me, I remember where I came from and the shape that I was in when I walked through the door. And I also need to thank Katrina too, because we were friends in the street. And she never once preached to me. She only said, aren't you tired yet? And it was like about her year that I walked through the door. And she was the one that opened the door for me. and not only that, did they give you, physical, emotional, whatever kind of help you need, they also work on dental.
Provides pro bono service to providing. There's a lot of things need to be fixed, that we don't have insurance for. We thank him a lot.
Oh yeah. He's one of my angels.
We have many.
It seems like you're so successful, and obviously you've had some knocks along the way and stuff, but what do you keep your eye on, or what are the two or three things that you think are key to that? I mean, you've talked about the spiritual aspect. A lot of people go on the way.
I think that's what makes us really different, is our acceptance and the love of the community. It's not, oh, here's a security guard at the front desk, do you have an appointment? It's not like that. It's just never like that. And I think you also have to keep on top of clinical, what's the best clinical treatment for the women, and be, because, our women don't have access to good psychiatric services. I mean, they have a psychiatrist once a month at Cook County who gives them medication whether they need it or not. So we try to provide quality programming and clinical services because they don't have. That's one of the reasons people who don't have money don't get that care, because they don't have the money for good care. So obviously they don't get well, and then it's kind of a blame the victim. And the third thing is obviously funding, because without funding, we shut our doors, and we learned that lesson really the hard way. Seriously, the hard way. There was no money in the bank, and we didn't know how we were going to keep going. So I think funding's always ultimately, and it's a. For me, I have to spend too much time on it,
And I don't really particularly, because I'd rather be with the women and be downstairs more. But I know in my heart that if I don't get the money, there's no Genesis House. So I feel sometimes terrible for that, because that's a conflict for me, because I have to be at meetings and talking to people and flying to Washington and doing the stuff I have to do. But I know we wouldn't be there otherwise, so I have to do it. I have to discipline myself to do it. And I was never a fundraiser before, and now I'm a fundraiser. It's different.
Thank God, she's a good one.
They don't get out of the room until they give me money. Okay, how much do you want? They'll give the money.
Well, I've worked in outreach for a while as a volunteer a number of years ago when I had a sabbatical for my teaching job. And one of the things that I thought worked fabulously well, especially in outreach, especially with women on the street, is an asset-based approach to outreach, which is that when women come into the house for a sandwich or for a nap or for clean clothes or for whatever they come for, talk to them about, and I think Genesis House does this just intuitively, talk to them about their lives as though they're whole people. They're not there as hookers and addicts. Then as you hold a mirror up to them that says, you have skills and capacities and abilities, and you have people you love, you have things you care about, you have heart, hands, and head, you know things. You know, I often ask, what were you good at in school, and what do you love to do, and what can you do with your hands, and stuff like that. And so that kind of a image is addictive, because it's whole. It's a child of God. It's not a set of problems, it's a whole person. And you ask a person off the street those questions enough time, and she's going to get addicted to that image of herself.
Right.
Which is the way that all of us should have been raised, and many of us weren't. You know, the sense of ourselves with good parenting, we got it, a lot of us. You know, that we're capable, whole persons. And it's so valuable. It's just incredibly important that we do that at Genesis House. Because people come back for that, and then they come back for it a third time and a fourth time, and then they come back and say, finally, I'm tired. Like Katrina said to Debbie, aren't you tired? Why did they say, I'm tired, I want to come in? But that's because often it's because they've gotten the sense of themselves as a whole person there, a kind of a glimpse of who they could be.
And they see the women in the program, and they become, I could be there. If she can be there, I can be there. So it's very powerful. And also, a caveat to that is they do, we have their Christian names. So if they have a street name that they used on the street, they go back to their real names in the program. And that's really important, part of dropping the street identity too. Sometimes it takes a little while to find out the real name. Any other questions?
Are you establishing reciprocal relationships with other similar programs elsewhere? I would guess that maybe occasionally one of the best things for a woman getting off the street is to get out of tail too.
Right. And we also, we were the national model. We had a mayor's grant, and so we go, I've set up programs in Jacksonville, for example, different places. And normally they come to us to find out how to do it in the summer when they can go to a Cubs game. But I actually got to go to Jacksonville in the winter, which was really nice in the programming. And we do have reciprocal relationships with, but actually we're the only and the largest in the Midwest. There's one in Springfield called Cora, which is a strong, we're strongly involved with one another in programming. And we do visit other programs. You might have been in the workshop, but I just visited San Francisco, and they had a full-time acupuncturist, which I was just so envious of. And they had a lot of more holistic things, and we'll be looking at that more in our programming, bringing more holistic treatment and into it. So we try it all. And by computer, via computer, and then sometimes we're on panels, maybe national panels together, so we all talk. And in Illinois, when you testify, actually the women all over the state were up testifying, so we got to see each other. So we do all keep in contact, but the reality is, I mean, they can go to other drug programs. We are the only program in the Midwest for women prostitution.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
How about the West?
Let's see, there's one in Arizona. There's one in Texas. There's one in New York, there's one in Boston, there's one in Washington, there's one in Baltimore.
When you say Washington, you mean Washington,
D.C. D.C. There is actually one in Washington State as well. I can't remember the name right now. But we always try and call each other, and when we go for federal funding, we were one of only 25 recipients of Congressional Black Caucus money last year, which we were very grateful for. And this year there's about 75 recipients, and it's to build your organization. If they think you have a good idea and they're doing a good thing, they gave us funding to enlarge our outreach. And we all meet there. So you get a pretty good idea nationally what's going on, and you all talk to each other. If you don't know about something, I just found out about one in Oakland, which I didn't know about, and I found out about that in Washington. So I think luckily, in a way, because of the federal funding, we all are sort of exchanging information with each other.
There's a group in Portland, Oregon that organizes Sex by Sex Workers Film Festival. And one of their main focuses was a documentary that was done in the California women's prison system. And when I went to that, it was very powerful for me to see that this group of women that were tied into such a heinous trade were working with other women to bring about, safety, health. There's also a small group in Portland, Oregon, that is doing prostitution alternatives.
Yeah, and I've talked with them, and I can't remember their name.
Yeah, I lost track of them too. I met them at a big conference thing, and there was only two of the five people that were involved in it at the conference, so it's pretty tiny.
One of the women there corresponds with me, and Andrea Dworkin, I think her name is, did a film. It was actually shot there. I think it was shot in Portland. And it's a really scary film because they actually interview people, and they interview a woman who obviously, has dissociative disorder, and she starts to talk about blankly how she used her baby in prostitution and eventually the baby got killed. And she's really unsure if that was bad or not. She's confused about it because that's what happened to her as a child. It's Andrew Dworkin's film. I can't remember the title.
I just wanted to say a word of thanks to the women who are here from Genesis House, particularly those of you who are the residents and have been through so much and come such a long way. And just your presence here this week, I think has really been a benefit to the whole community. And I especially appreciate the chance to hear each of you speak at this group, because for me, I spent my whole life in the church and religion, and throwing words around like the gospel and redemption and salvation and freedom and all this, and which I believe in, but it's so easy to forget or to not even know what that means. And but hearing from you all, I mean, it's like so real and it's so true, and it just puts me in touch with some of the real gut feelings that I have, and the gratitude that I have about being lifted up and being given a new life, a new hope. And so I appreciate your sharing that with us, because sometimes the rest of us get a little, kind of forget what it's all about. Thank you.
Thank you, everybody.
Thank you.